At long last, I can say I'm so excited to share the first Take Flight event for 2 years will be taking place on the 7th of October, starting at 6:30 p.m. in London King's Cross. We'll be learning what it takes to build a championship mindset by spending the evening dissecting the minds of some of Britain's greatest ever champions. All panel speakers will be announced in the coming weeks, so keep your eyes on my Instagram page for some exciting updates. But today, I can proudly share the headline speaker delivering the keynote at the event is the very special former WBA world champion boxer himself, George Groves. George fought for 10 years professionally, also adding the European, British and Commonwealth titles to his list of achievements. He's an outstanding athlete, outstanding competitor and, most importantly, human being. He speaks so well. He's such a character, full of energy, and I can't wait to have him speaking at the event on the 7th of October. Tickets are available now through the Eventbrite link in my bio. These events need to be experienced to be understood. The energy in the room is unlike anything I've experienced before, and I believe a lot of that is because those who sit in the audience are just as impressive as those who sit on the panel. People have found jobs with one another, collaborated on podcasts and beyond, and become ambassadors of brands they've met at these events. And the 7th of October is set to be the biggest one so far. It's set to be an unbelievable evening. An evening that will lift us up after the last 2 years. A night for the first time ever where five of Britain's greatest ever champions will be in the same room, all in aid of sharing their lessons with you and I. I can't wait to share the space and meet as many of you as possible. See you there.
You know, no one's ever had a eureka moment of the solution come to them when they're stressed. Their best ideas come to them when they're walking or you're doing exercise at the end of the day. That's when the creativity comes, when we've switched off. You don't get the eureka moment in the stress of the busy day.
Hey guys, welcome to Take Flight, a peak performance movement driven to inspire you and help you get closer to your goals each and every day. I'm Mark Whittle, performance coach, motivational speaker and host of this podcast. And this week's guest is the amazing Anna Hemmings, MBE OLY. Anna is Britain's most successful ever kayaker, a two-time Olympian and a six-time world champion. She achieved things in a kayak no one had done before and no one's done since. Anna retired as an athlete in 2009. And created a leading high-performance training consultancy called Beyond Barriers, where she translates the lessons she learned in sport into the business world, helping today's business leaders find their competitive edge. She is truly magnificent, and I was in my element having this conversation. Anna and I have several things in common, including, of course, being a performance coach and a former athlete, but also we both suffered with chronic fatigue at different times in our lives, and it was amazing to compare the lessons we learned from our biggest challenges. Anna is an absolute force. We talk about so much in this conversation, from how to curate a winner's mindset, to finding our purpose, how to motivate yourself and importantly others, tips on achieving high performance, and how to practice visualization and reflection in order to achieve anything we want. It was such an honor and a pleasure to speak with Anna. Without further ado, please enjoy this special chat with the amazing Olympian, coach, athlete, and legend, Anna Hemmings. Enjoy. Anna, welcome to the Take Flight podcast.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me here. We've got this VIP special room.
I know, lucky us.
It's nice. So we were just chatting outside. I've been really excited to speak with you. It's been a long time coming, not that you know, but you've been on my radar for such a long time because people who have listened to the podcast have often recommended to have you on.
So, oh, that's interesting. That's great. It's lovely to know.
Yeah. Nice. So I've been looking forward to it. There's lots of things that we have in common. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Should we start with what you do on a typical week? So you got your coaching, the sort of seminars you deliver, the talks that you do as well. If it was a typical week, and most people I speak to don't have a typical week, but what do you do sort of day to day?
Yeah, so in the world that I live in and the nature of the work that I do, there really isn't a typical week, as you guessed. But so I wear three different hats, really. So I'm a motivational speaker, I'm a training consultant, and I'm a high performance leadership coach. And all three of those have the same theme, really. You know, I'm helping people to, whether that be leaders, teams, individuals, to develop the mindset, the skills, the behaviours to deliver outstanding performance. And I use my background from the world of sport as an Olympian, world champion in kayak racing to take those lessons. I did that for the best part of 15, 20 years. and learned lots of invaluable life lessons. And it's about taking those lessons and combining them with the research that I've done, the training that I've done over the last 12 years since founding Beyond the Barriers, my training consultancy, combining that with the psychology of performance and applying it into the business world. Mm. To help those people, you know, get the best out of themselves. So typically my week will range from delivering a workshop, all virtual at the moment. So delivering workshops that might be part of for example, I run an open resilient leadership workshop that runs every other week for 12 weeks. So I might be delivering that. It's a morning session. In the afternoon, I might have a coaching client. Next day, I might be doing a keynote. The following day, I might be at home and just preparing for that keynote or workshop or coaching client. So yeah, that some days are busy delivering, or working with clients, or it might be a preparation meeting with a client, or, you know, so when we get a new client, it's very much about understanding what their needs are. What are their objectives? Why do they want a speaker? Or why do they need a coach? Or what's the training objective? Or is this really the training you're asking me for? Training on leadership style or resilient leadership, but actually what's the objective and is that what you need, or is it something else you need? So that sort of scoping period with a client, designing programs, pitching for new programs, or, you know, so it's really it really is, when, you know, we say there's no typical week, it just is really varied, but there's always a mixture of those things are happening in my week. And then I have two kids, so in the middle of that, juggling two kids and being a mom and trying to exercise and have a life and all of that.
Yeah, that balance that doesn't exist
that we all strive for. Yeah.
So you said you wear three hats. Is there one that you favor more than the others?
Oh, it's really difficult because there's things that I love about all of them. So, when I do a keynote speech, typically, you know, when we were in person, very different to the virtual world now. But, you know, if you're in person, you're on a stage and you know, you could be speaking to 500 people, 1,000 people. And I think the performer in me from my sporting days really loves that, because you get a bit nervous before, and I'm going to get up on stage and you get that sort of little bit of performance anxiety, and I've sort of visualized it in my mind. I'm going to go out, I'm going to perform, I'm going to deliver a great speech for these guys. I want to deliver my best so that they can take something really valuable away. So I sort of get myself worked up for that, and I love it. And you know, generally great feedback, and people come up to me and, oh, can you tell me more about this? And I found that inspiring, or they're talking about the illness that I talk about, and, you know, all those things. And so I get lots of immediate feedback from that. And I love that whole performance. Then at the other extreme is one-to-one coaching, which is with one person rather than 500 people. And then, you know, like we were saying, you get to know that one person over, you know, most of my coaching sessions start with a 6-month block of coaching, and more often than not, it carries on. And so you get to know people pretty well. And I love seeing people develop over that time and achieve their goals and overcome those barriers and change their mindset and all of that. And that's so rewarding for me. And that's why I do all of this. You know, I want to help people. I want to see them transform. And when you do the keynote, you don't get to often see the aftermath and what they've applied. And, you know, some people will email me, and quite often, you know, an organization who I've spoken to, they'll say, can you come in and do some training? And so you might do, but, and then I enjoy the dynamic of a small group workshop where you've got 10 or 12 people, and there's a different dynamic because we've got a little group of people, and people are, you know, firing off each other and bouncing off each other. So I haven't answered your question because I really do enjoy all of them, and that's why I do all three rather than just focusing on one. And I know a lot of coaches, for example, just like, I'm just a coach and that's what I do. But my career in this world started out as a speaker, which I was doing since I won my first world title. You know, my sponsors were asking me to come and speak at their events and things like that. So I've been doing that for 20 odd years. So I've always done that, but I didn't want to just do that. And I've wanted to, and I love that variety. Mm-hmm. And the meeting of different people and getting to know different people. So
now you've answered the question perfectly. I think there's a consistent theme with nearly everyone that I speak with, that they have variety in their week, and that allows them to bounce from, not necessarily bounce, but choose when to flip their attention. You can deliver something and have focused attention on something, whether it's coaching in a one-to-one session or whatever. And when you might deliver three or four of those in a week, and then it's like, whoa, because they can be quite intense. And then you go, do you know what? Tomorrow is great though, because I've got a talk in front of, you know, hundreds of people, and that's going to be a different performance. It's going to ask different things of me, and I can grow in another way. And it's really nice to hear you talk about that, because I was trying to kind of think for myself what I love about everything that I do. I suppose I wear three hats with a podcast, speaking or events, hosting events, and the coaching. And the podcast and the events, it's all public facing. So it's always, you know, and like you said, you don't always get the feedback. But with a coaching, you can see the development of someone. You have to be patient, and you watch them over, like you said, 6 months or longer sometimes, to see them change the way they see the world. And then you hear them sometimes saying things that you've said to them, and it's like, yes, it's sinking in, it's working.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to speak with you about three key areas, and got like a running theme through each one. So mindset, adversity, and performance. So we start with mindset, given that we're talking about your coaching stuff already. And the area that I wanted to touch on first was self-doubt. And I think that there's two forms of self-doubt. There's what we have as self-doubt. It's us internally, intrinsically, we think we can't achieve something or we can't do something. And then there's doubters, so externally, people who put doubt on you. And then you can choose how you take that. I'm sure this is a running theme about every single performer that you've spoken with, and you will have had experience with this yourself. But to those who are listening who have experienced self-doubt, and sometimes that I might not even have the awareness of that, where do you start?
Oh, it's a big question. I mean, absolutely everyone has it, right? You know, even the best performers in the world, you know, Olympic champions, world champions, everyone has self-doubt. And I think that's the first thing to recognise, and that's okay. And we're not alone. And like you say, the first most important step is to notice it. That self-talk, that little voice that's going, you can't do this, you're not good enough, and you're never going to make it, and what's the point in trying, and all that negative self-talk, that little devil on your shoulder that, you know, is gibbering away at you. I think the first thing is just to be aware of it, because that self-talk is so automatic and it's just running commentary that's going on all the time in the background, and we can't change what we don't notice. So my first step for clients is to catch it, to just stop. And I think when we're living such busy lives like we do, and we're, you know, there's that term of partial inattention, you know, where we're just constantly never fully tuned into one thing, and we're just constantly tuned into everything, so many different things, and then you're never fully focused on one thing. And so in that pace of life, when do you even stop to hear what's going on, to notice what's going on in your mind and your body? And so I think the first thing is to just slow down and notice it. And then once you notice it, catch it, and then challenge it. And challenge, is this thought helpful to me? Is it helping me towards what I'm trying to achieve? Is it helping me in this moment focus on what I'm trying to do? Is it helping me and my confidence? Is it helping me to step up on stage and present? You know, all of that. So catch it, challenge it. And, you know, am I seeing, or, you know, maybe even a situation that you're presented with, or an adversity or whatever it might be, and potentially reframe it. You know, am I seeing this situation as a threat, or am I seeing it as an opportunity? You know, like, for example, when I was competing, quite often having won a couple of world titles, eventually you start to become the favourite for the race, and then you turn up. And I remember racing in the UK. We had a world championships in 2001 in Stockton-on-Tees. And naturally, I'd won already. I was the favourite. It was on home water. So there was big expectation. And you know, everyone you speak to, yeah, you're going to win it. You're going to be fine. You're going to be great. You're going to win. And then I was just like, oh my God, everyone thinks I'm going to win. And what if I don't? What if I mess it up? And, you know, and all that doubt starting to creep in. What if I mess it up? And then I'd be so embarrassing to be the favourite and then to lose, and on home water, and all of that. And so I was seeing that as a threat. What people are saying in this situation, I'm seeing it as a threat. And that threat leads to feelings of stress and anxiety, and, you know, it raising that nervousness and all of that. And when it gets out, you know, that could get out of control. And then, your chances of performing at your best are slim, and you know you're focused on all the negatives and the doubt and the confidence drops, and we know that when we have those emotions of fear and panic and anxiety, then, you know, like we were talking about earlier, that emotional center of the brain takes over, and then we can't think clearly, and I can't get on the water and be like that and think, I'm not going to be strategic in my thinking, I'm not going to make great decisions, I'm not going to be responsive. And so you've got to learn to calm that. And so, you know, the first step is noticing that you're having those thoughts. Otherwise, it then leads to the emotion and then leads to the behavior. Mm-hmm. So it's about catching it, challenging it, and going, actually, you know, in that situation, how can I see this as an opportunity? How can I reframe it? And so catch it, challenge it, change it is my process. Nice. So let's notice it and realize it's not helpful, and then let's change it. What would be a more helpful thought? So actually, these people keep saying that they think I'm going to win and I'm the favorite because they believe in me. And actually, I am in really great shape and I've done all the training and I know I'm ready. And so this is a brilliant opportunity to go out and put all that training into practice and show them that I'm the best in the world. Wow, now I'm excited. Now I can't wait to race. And so it can be as simple as that. And it's not always as easy as that, because that's just a one-off scenario where we're hearing these doubts, but it's not, some people have that continuous, you're just not good enough. You know, why are you even bothering? You know, and that's every day, or oh, you did it again. You made a mistake again. You cocked it up. You did that, you know, and there's that continuous running negative commentary. And then we have to work a little bit harder to change those thoughts. And that takes a bit more time and it takes a bit more practice. And I use a lot of techniques, you know, around NLP and changing some of our beliefs and, you know, just helping people to recognize, I'm sure you do all of this as well, helping them to think, actually, is that thought accurate? And just that question alone, is it accurate? Is it the truth? Is it helping you? No. So let's change it, you know? So when my daughter comes to me, she says, oh, but I'm so rubbish at maths, I hate maths. I'm like, well, is that helping you to do your homework? Is that thought helpful? Well, no, not really. Well, what would be a more helpful thought? You know, and how can we change this to something that, yeah, maybe I don't like it, but how can I work through this? And how can I accept that I've got to do it? And how can I try and learn to like it a little bit? Because otherwise, just thinking that this is boring and I don't like it, it's not going to, you've got to do it. The bottom line is you have to do it, and you need to change your thought process to one that's going to be more helpful, because you're going to do this for the next 8 years. So, you know, might as well change now.
I think what so many people don't understand, perhaps, it might not be fair, but a lot of people don't understand, is the important thing you said is it's habitual, it's automatic, you said. And we don't realize it's something that's been built up over so many years, and our conditioning is so strong that however our mind is fixed or wired now or coded, however you want to say it, like that's happened over a very long period of time. So to change that is difficult. But what people don't really understand is that it's done from a place of safety, of security. Like our ego is trying to keep us safe. So that thought of, you know, let's use your daughter as an example, the thought of, I hate my maths homework, I don't want to do it. Probably underneath there is a fear of failure. Oh, I'm going to do the homework and I'm going to get a crap mark or something like that. That might be the fear that bubbles underneath that. But and that's why the ego says, I hate it, because don't let me put myself out there, because then I can't fail and I can't be judged and I can't be criticized and all those other things. And that's why, as cliche as the term sounds, getting comfortable being uncomfortable, that's what we need to do. You almost need to, like, I do this for myself, just away from clients and stuff, is if it feels scary, just do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just force yourself almost.
Yeah, that's where the growth happens, right? Mm. Yeah, we totally have to step out of our comfort zone if we are going to grow. And yeah, and like you say, being outside of the comfort zone is uncomfortable. But the more you do it, the more comfortable it becomes, right? Mm. You know, I do that regularly with people who are, you know, it's that fear of presenting or something, it's scary. Well, actually, it's just that sort of small exposure, just little steps of exposure, just do it a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. I've got, you know, with my son, he just did a grading yesterday in kickboxing and he hates the grading. Like, that's the fear of failure. It's 100% fear of failure. But every time, so he did, he's only seven, and he mm-hmm. so he's been doing it for 2 or 3 years, and he got a black belt in his little age group for under eight. He got that in Christmas time, I think, and he was so nervous for that. And then today he's moved up to another level, and he was starting again at white and trying to get a yellow belt yesterday. And actually, he said, I'm not as scared. He was like, oh, I don't really like grading. So, but actually, I'm not as scared as last time. I was like, that's because you've done, you know, orange, red, yellow, blue, brown, black. You know, you've done 6 or 7 gradings now, and you're getting used to it. And that's, it's just going to, every time he says, I still don't really want to do it. He loves the actual every day for every week practicing, but it's the grading. And I just, it's just going to get easier. Every time you do one of those gradings, you're going to realize actually, you know, it was fine and got through it. Still alive, still love the sport. And it's just that little bit of exposure, pushing yourself. And I said, look how far you've come every time you do it. And now I said to him, now you know how to deal with that kind of situation. He's only seven, but he's got a mum who's like all over the sports psychology. I'm like, you know what to do. You know what I told you to think about last time, and how to just stay a little bit calm and breathe. You know, I'm like, now when you go play football and you're going to take a little, you're playing on the match with your pitch with your friends, and you know what to do. You know what to focus on, and you're just going to apply that in every other scenario.
Well, sport is so amazing because it just gives everybody that exposure. I can't wait for my kid to start doing it. And it's funny, I think I was having this thought the other day, just as about myself, is I used to have a lot of impatience about wanting to get somewhere, but then you recognize that if you can't get there without those steps, and the grading system you spoke about there sums it up perfectly, doesn't it? Because each time you get a new belt, it's warming you for the next stage. If you just went straight there, you know, in my mind, I'm like, I want my event to be in front of 12,000 people.
You're not ready.
It's like, if I just went there, I'd be like, so overworked. You earn that with each step.
Yeah.
Each time you stand up and talk, and each time you have that experience.
Yeah, because when he did the black belt at Christmas, he was the most nervous for that than any of the other gradings. It was really, because it was the black belt, was a really big deal. But if he'd gone from yellow to black, it just wouldn't have happened. And luckily, along the way, he missed one. I think it was blue, maybe. He didn't get it on that day. And then they said, come back to the Saturday session and try again. So it was really good that he missed one. Because I was like, well, if you don't get it, what's going to happen? He says, oh, well, maybe I'll get to try again on Saturday. I thought, well, there you go. You're just going to try again. You don't get it. Life's not going to end. We'll still love you. And, you know, life will carry on and you'll try again. And you'll ask the teacher, what did I do wrong? And you'll try and put it right for next time. It's simple as that.
Amazing.
And so, yeah, you need to go through that little process of just pushing a little bit and a little bit and a little bit.
Yeah, so good. I'm glad you just said that, because I heard something the other day which I loved. It's like, if you fail, just telling your kid, I love you no matter what, it gives you permission to fail again. It was Kobe Bryant. I heard a clip of him saying it the other day.
Yeah, I literally had this conversation with Luke on, I think it was Wednesday. This was yesterday. This was Wednesday morning. Yeah, at breakfast. He came down to his breakfast and he just straight away went, Mummy, what happens if I don't get my belt today? And I was like, well, I'll still love you, whether you get the belt or not. I don't care whether you get the belt. Well, I do care. I care for you. I want you to get it for you, but I'm still going to love you, whether you get that belt or not. It really doesn't matter. I'd love you to get it. It'd be amazing and you'll be really happy, but it really doesn't matter. In the grand scheme of things, I'm still going to love you.
Amazing.
That's all they need to hear, right? Because as a child, I don't want to be that mum who's putting pressure on my kid. You know, he does it, he loves it. Yes, he doesn't love the grading, but he's kind of got to do it if he loves the sport and he wants to do the sport every week. And so you've got to do the grading at the end of term. But I just like, you know, if you love it, great, keep doing it. But I don't want you to do it and hate it because there's a pressure to perform. I just want you to know that, you know, just I love you whether you win or lose or you become a champion or whatever. It doesn't matter to me. If that's what you want to do, then I'll be here and I'll help you and I'll help your mindset and I'll help you, give you all the tools I can give you to do that. But you've got to want to do it and I'll be there whether you win or lose.
Lucky kid to have you as his mum.
Hopefully.
So catch it, challenge it, change it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. And yeah. So I have a similar thing, exactly the same, really. Recognise, realise, recreate.
Oh, nice.
Same thing.
Yeah.
So you know, we talk about scientific level, it's, you know, you've created a neural pathway till now, which has a certain thought pattern, and that is your automatic thought pattern, whether that's positive or negative. But if you catch that, the changing part is creating a new neural pathway. So you talked about building change and changing habits and changing yourself. How can we do that? Because I think that is the scariest thing we can do. If we want to achieve something we never achieved before, we need to be someone we haven't been before, I believe. And that involves change, and change involves becoming someone else, and that involves having grief associated with losing maybe part of the old version of yourself. Like, there are so many things that come with changing. So how have you done that for yourself, firstly, and then how do you help people to change?
So what do you mean, changing something quite big? I mean, I had a huge change when I left my sport, and, you know, that's a change of identity. So that was really big. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's what I mean, yeah. A big change, a big pivotal moment in your life where you have to completely, you know, be a different person.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a massive thing in sport for athletes, is going from, this is who I am. I'm Anna the kayaker, and I'm Anna the Olympian, and I'm Anna who's really strong in the gym and who's fit and all of that. And then luckily I still, you know, there's this, like, once an Olympian, always Olympian. And, you know, two people write in, you know, Anna Hemmings, former Olympian. I'm like, no, not former Olympian. I'm always an Olympian. I might not be a current competing Olympian, but I'm always Olympian. So I get to keep that identity a little bit. But yeah, do you know what? I found it quite hard not being the strongest and not being super fit. And I sort of tailored off. So for me, that was like slowly moving away from that. And it took me a while to be okay with, it's okay if I can't lift this in the gym anymore, and I can't do 60 pull-ups, and I can't do 100 press-ups. And it's okay. You don't need to do that anymore. You don't need to prove that. Who are you proving that to? Why do you need to do that? And so that little bit of ego going, it's okay. It's okay. We don't have to be that person anymore, and you can excel at other things. And so it was about, I guess, it was about what do I want to do next, and what's my purpose, and who do I want to be, and what am I trying to achieve? What's my vision? What's my purpose in life? And I think that's the starting point. And I didn't know that immediately, and it took me a while to identify that. But that's what helped me change and helped me realize that, you know, we all have to change. We all have to evolve. I couldn't be stuck in Anna the athlete, because I'm not anymore. And so you have to move on.
How long did it take you to identify that? Because I think a lot of people think that they can do that quite quickly.
No, you can't. And I think that is also why a lot of, you know, sport today, there's a whole, what do they call it? Like the athlete... It was called the ACE program at the EIS, and I can't remember, athlete career education or something, about helping athletes to have something in their life that was more, whether that was education and doing a course or uni, or, you know, building up those skills and having hobbies and other stuff in your life. So you don't have this fixation with, my identity is purely this sport and this is who I am. Actually, I need to have other things, so that my identity is also, I love drawing and I love art, or whatever it is. I'm crap at art. But, you know, what is that for those, for everybody? So that also I've got a bit of a path to walk that's easier when I retire, which is really hard as an athlete, because you don't want to think about retirement. You're in the moment and you're like, this is what I'm focused on, and I'll deal with that later and what I'm going to do in 4 years' time. I want to focus on what I'm doing right now, and I'm going to give all my attention to that. But I do think it gives you a bit more balance when you can have something else in your life, and it helps maintain the perspective. And as long as it's not detracting from your training and your recovery from training, then I think it's really helpful to have something else as an athlete. But, you know, moving on, you know, in anyone, whether that's changing a career, you know, women coming back from maternity, and actually it gives you a time to think, actually, what do I want to do? Maybe I don't want to go back to my old job and I want to recreate and do something else. And I think it's about embracing what I had and what can I take from that, and thinking, you know, what, so for me, you know, my job today is totally 100% different to what I used to do. But I'm bringing all the skills and all the learning to my new job. And every skill is transferable. You know, there's so many skills. And whether, you know, like, you've come from a sales background to doing podcasts and coaching. But there's so many skills, like, that you've learned from, you know, that from the world of sales that you're applying right now to build your business and to get clients and to, you know, get people to your events and all of that. So those skills, it's about recognizing, yeah, I might be starting new, but I've still got so many strengths and so many skills that I can bring with me. And I think that's what gives us the confidence to recreate and to change and go in a new direction. It's the foundation of all our confidence is identifying our strengths and focusing on them. And that's what helps us to go, I'm just going to embrace this new adventure. And yeah, it's going to be scary, but that's how we grow. Like we just said, right? Yeah, we've got to change and got to move on, or maybe don't have to, but if that's, you know, if this is what it is and I want to go in a different direction, then building up that confidence that I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I know I have the skills to find a way and that I'll make it happen. And so I think working on confidence is really crucial, because that's what allows you to have, you know, having confidence in who I am, not just what I do. I think that's the difference. And that's a big part of, you know, the work that I do now. We talk about resilient leadership, and we are at the foundation of our definition of resilient leadership is confidence in who I am and what I do. And a lot of people focus on what I do, but not so much on the who I am. And I think that is crucial, because that when you're making change, it's, yeah, what I do, I don't really know what I'm doing now or next, but I do have confidence in who I am. And that's crucial for change.
That's amazing. I'm writing a talk at the minute that I'd love to run by you
after. Yeah, please do.
It's like it's music to my ears, what you're saying. So I wanted to speak with you about motivation. There was some questions I was going to ask you off the back of that, but let's move on to motivation, because I think it kind of ties into it anyway. So I think when you're an athlete, or because part of what you were talking about there is really like labels, isn't it? It's labels in society that make you identify with the job title or your position within society, rich or poor or whatever, rather than, like you said, really knowing who you are. And a lot of that comes down to extrinsic or intrinsic motivation. So if you're extrinsically motivated to be the next manager of that team or to be the CEO of that thing or whatever, that can get you so far. But what can people do to motivate themselves? It's one of the questions I get more than anything, is how can I consistently wake up in the morning and have energy to go and do it again and go and do it again? And whether you want to draw on from your coaching or how you manage to consistently achieve over years as a athlete, as a kayaker, were you 6-time world champion?
Yes.
6-time world champion.
Yeah.
And of course, competing in 2 Olympics as well. So how can we wake up every morning and maintain that level of motivation?
So I think you're absolutely right. I think it's about tapping into understanding what our intrinsic motivation is, because the extrinsic is for me in the world of sport, you know, it was the medals, it was the records, the awards. And, you know, in the world of work, it's the salary, the bonus, you know, the promotion. That's the extrinsic motivation. But the problem with that is that it's temporary. And on a cold, dark winter's morning in January, you know, and the Olympics is 2 years away, or the World Championships is 8 months away, that's not always enough. You know, yes, that is a big driver. You know, I've got to turn up today because I want to win the World Championships in 8 months' time. But on some days, you need more than that. And particularly if you're doing the same thing over and over again, you need more than that. And so for me, some days it was about turning up. I was motivated to turn up for training because of the competitive nature of the training session. You know, there was other people in my training group, and I knew it was one of those sessions where it was going to be nose to nose all the way. And I loved that. And I would get a sense of achievement out of that. So I won 6 out of the 10 efforts, or 8 of them, or whatever, or we were being timed and, you know, we hit the target times. So for me, it was that sense of competition or sense of achievement that I was going to get from the training session. On other days, it might have been about the affiliation, you know, teammates, having fun, you know, and having a bit of laugh with my teammates. And yeah, I just want to go and have a bit of banter with them, and we're going to have a bit of a laugh and joking around and that kind of stuff. And so that would get me out of bed. And so I think that, so for me, I know that one of my drivers is a sense of achievement. So, but it's about identifying what are those drivers. And I talk a lot about the work of Dean Spitzer, actually, and he identified 8 human desires. So there's the desire for ownership. So having real a sense of ownership into your work, like if you're working on a project, right, this is my little baby, this project is mine and I'm owning this and I'm going to present it back. Or it might be desire for power. And that might be about, you know, positions of power or feelings of control. Or it might be about actually feeling like I'm in control of my destiny, so that external forces aren't shaping our lives. Or so the third one would be desire for achievement. So that feeling, you know, we all have a feeling of needing to feel like we're succeeding. And when you have a strong desire for that, it's about overcoming, you know, you'd work really hard to overcome an obstacle if you've got a sense of achievement driver. Another one might be meaning. So a desire for meaning to, you know, wanting to feel like your efforts are making, no matter how small, are making a difference. We want to have a reason for doing something. So if I'm, you know, there's a great story about a guy at NASA. So there was a big, they were doing, I'm going off on tangent here, but
I love it.
The there was a, I think it was Deloitte or some big consulting company. I can't remember who it was, Deloitte Accountancy, aren't they? But anyway, it was a big consulting firm and they were doing this survey of loads of really high performing organizations and they were at NASA. And so they turn up at NASA and they were interviewing lots of different people. And so they'd interviewed various, you know, the astronauts and all these people. And then there was this janitor and he was like in his, you know, cleaning clothes. And they said to him, so what do you do? And he says, oh, well, I help put people on the moon. And they're like, you're the janitor. And so there's a couple of guys in the group who are just sort of, you know, mocking. And then there was one guy who was like, okay, so tell us a bit more about that. And he said, so, you know, as well as cleaning the floors and making sure that this place is, you know, in a great environment to work in, I actually clean the suits for the astronauts. And if those suits aren't efficiently and effectively cleaned, when that astronaut steps out into space, then he could die. And so those suits need to be cleaned really, really well. And I'm trained in using special products and all of this to clean those suits. And so when he said in the beginning, I help people on space, he knew that what he did, no matter how small, he wasn't building rockets and, you know, spaceships and all of that. But he knew that the small part that he played made a massive difference, or made a small difference, you know, made a difference though, and had an impact on the mission of NASA to put people in space or on the moon or wherever. And that's the power of having a meaning. And that's a huge driver for a lot of people wanting to know that I know by how what I do contributes to the bigger picture, to the purpose of this organization, to the vision, to the project or whatever it is. So that's a really big driver. And I'll just tell you the others. There's desire for competence, desire for affiliation, so that team thing, desire for recognition. You know, we all want to feel appreciated and recognized for our work. And then desire for activity, which is about not wanting to do monotonous, boring stuff every day. So it's really about identifying, what am I being fulfilled at work? Am I getting enough of that? So if my driver is being recognized, do I get recognized by my boss, by my people, the people around me? Am I getting that sense of appreciation for what I do? And if not, how do I get more of that? Or is my driver about ownership? How can I own a project or a piece of work or development of someone else? So how can I get that? And as a leader, wanting to motivate others, understanding what is it for your team? How do you motivate others? And are you tapping into those deepest motivations? Because that's when you get a longer, more sustained motivation, is when you understand what the intrinsic drivers are of each individual in your team. And then you can start, because quite often what happens is people, a leader will go, oh, well, my driver's recognition. And so they're constantly giving recognition to their team. And it's all about, oh, you did amazing. And I love that job you did. And, you know, recognizing you with a reward and this and that. And they're going, I'm not bothered about that. That doesn't do it for me. I'm all about the people and the team and being engaged and having great teammates to come to work for every day. That's what ticks my box. And then that's a real light bulb moment for a lot of the leaders I work with. They go, ah, oh, what they're motivated by isn't the same as what I'm motivated by. And so I need to change and start to, yeah, mine is this, that's great. But actually I need to help them with that driver, because that's what's going to help get a longer, more sustained motivation on a daily basis.
so many people, myself included, make the mistake of you just reflect outward what you have, don't you?
Yeah.
Whatever your values are, you just assume. It's like, well, you must feel the same as me.
Yeah.
So just to reflect on those. So the eight needs you said were ownership.
Yeah. Desire. Yeah. He called them human desires. Yeah.
Human desires. Okay. Ownership, power, meaning, competence, affiliation, recognition, activity. We've got all of them there. Was that seven? Achievement.
Yeah.
Really interesting. I have to look in more of that. I think off the back of that, I'd love to ask if you could distill it down. How can listeners find more meaning with, you don't have to necessarily use that model, but what can they ask themselves or what can they start doing today if they're feeling a little bit purposeless or lacking direction? How can they understand what their meaning is?
Their meaning in life, what their purpose in life is.
Yeah. I know, it's a big
one. That's a big one. Yeah, I mean, that's hard, isn't it? I think it's easier if you're working in a team or an organisation and understanding what the meaning, the purpose of the organisation is. What's the bigger vision and what's the purpose? And then am I tapping into that and am I making a difference to that? That's a little bit easier to figure out. And if I'm not, how can I? What can I be doing that to make sure that my contribution is going to make a difference? Or just some people might not even know what the meaning is, or some organizations might not even have a purpose. So that's difficult. But then, so what really floats my boat? And so if it's not, or if you're, you know, it's your own business, then what's the purpose? What's the bigger difference that we're going to make in the world here? And how can we make a difference?
Does that come down to having like some sort of mission statement or a mantra or?
Yeah, I think so. But I think, you know, mission statement's quite, you know, for the sort of, is very much more external, and a vision is a bit more internal in terms of an organization. This is our vision, but our mission statement for the world is this. But I think as long as people understand what it is and you get them engaged with it, and this is why we're here, this is our bigger purpose. It's not just about making these products or X or Y. It's about helping people change their health or their lifestyle or their, you know, improve their living standards or whatever it might be.
Putting people on the moon.
You're putting people on the moon or, you know, so whatever it is. And what, even if you're running your own business or you're, you know, whatever it is, if you're a one man band, then what's my purpose? What's the bigger difference that I'm making? How do I want to serve people? Mm. I think when we're, you know, I think there's a lot of research out about when we're serving others and something bigger than ourselves, that's when we have a meaning.
Yeah.
And that's what can get us out of bed more easily every day because we're doing it for everyone else. And you hear, listen, it's interesting. I was listening to Gareth Southgate, obviously, at the weekend, not on the weekend, on Tuesday, in his post-match interview. And he talked about how the players, yes, they, you know, they want to get to the final, but they were very much, it was a little bit of a shift in mindset where he was much about, you know, we want to create, we're there for the fans, we're there for the, to create history, but we're there for the British people. It, you know, it was like deflecting it away, actually. There's a bigger picture here. It isn't just about, you know, a team of 15 men who are trying to pick up a trophy. This was about the fans. And doing it for England and all of that kind of stuff rather than, and I think when you've got that bigger purpose, just puts it all into perspective, isn't it? It's about other people we're here for. It's not about us and our ego.
Yeah.
And I think that can help. You know, it was like, do you know God, I'm doing that thing where I'm just talking.
Please, I love it.
Like, big, yeah, doing a Steve Redgrave. you know the GB, I love the GB hockey women who won in Rio, in the Rio Olympics. Yeah. They, back in 2008, set a mission statement or their sort of their vision. And it was, I'm going to get it right now. It was to inspire the future, to make a difference and to create history. I don't know if it was in that order and exactly those words, but something along, I think that was it. And one of them, so one of those was, you know, to inspire the future generations or something like that. And so that was part of their thing. It was like, it's not just about us. It's about inspiring future generations. We're here, we want to make a difference. We want to create history. And so it's not just, yeah, yes, in order to do that, we got to win. But it's not just about for us winning a trophy. It was about other people. And I think that's brilliant because that gives you a bigger purpose in life.
It's superb. And it's such a hard question to answer. So I think you've done an incredible job because there is so much more to it. And you're absolutely right. If contribution's at the forefront, it kind of answers both questions about both the motivation and the meaning bit. And I'm really pleased you brought up the Southgate thing because that really hit me as well. Like listening to him, it's the first time I've ever heard anyone talk about that from a sporting perspective. We've all had a really tough 18 months and we're doing this for the nation to give them a good evening, to give them a good day and a celebration. It was like, wow, how can a group of people who A, love what they do anyway, playing on the biggest stage, not get on board with a mission of like give the people a celebration, and you are the ones who get to do that for them. And
what on a great honour.
Yeah.
So let's just do this for that honour that we're here today to help the nation feel better, give them like a lift in the spirits and something to celebrate.
I also think like I was just watching the way he was speaking and the way he holds himself, and he's not introverted, I wouldn't imagine, but he's quite reserved. He's quite not low energy, but just not too much, like a lot of coaches you can imagine. I think particularly traditional, and I don't know what your experience is like with coaches and managers, but traditionally, you know, you talk about old school managers shouting at people or bollocking people, and that's just, it just doesn't work. And I think finally people are getting onto that. And he seems to be really, you know, supportive. I feel like he would be very empathetic with people.
I agree. I think he's a brilliant manager, and I think he is really authentic.
Mm.
And I think that's what comes across, is that, I'm not that really big, loud, extroverted coach, and that's okay, because he's confident in who he is, right? Mm-hmm. He's confident in who he is and what he does, and therefore I'm just going to be who I am. And it is a slightly quieter style, but that doesn't mean I don't have the passion. Mm-hmm. You know, still absolutely, you know he's passionate, right? We can see the passion's there, despite the fact that he's not shouting and, you know, being loud and, you know, bold and all of that. He's quietly reflective, and, you know, he's just quietly building trust with the players. You know, the trust and the respect is amazing, I think, when you see that between him and the players. And that's just because he's getting to know them and wants to be this authentic leader who's showing some vulnerability in who he is. And that's just, he's just being who he is.
Do you know where I think that comes from, though? Which is going to be a perfect segue into my next question. What he went through missing the penalty in the Euros previously was awful. On an individual level, I imagine he went through all sorts of, you know, darkness, loneliness. To come through that and then probably giving him the drive to be the coach he is today and the person that he is today. And that's what adversity has the ability to do. And that's what I wanted to talk to you about as well, was two questions. Terrible technique of interviewing, but I'm going to start questions. So could you speak so well and articulately about everything that we've just discussed there? Would the Anna in 2005, say, have articulated it in the same way? Would you have spoken about your motivations in the same way? And what was that journey of adversity for you? So it was chronic fatigue syndrome, which we'll talk about more now. What did that do? What's that process done for you? Or did you have the same beliefs before, you know, when you were competing as an athlete? Were you the same person with the same philosophies? How did the adversity, and if you could kind of give some context to what you went through as well, that'd be great. But how has that changed your mind, if at all, and the way that you operate?
It changed hugely. But I think, you know, as you, as you grow older, and then because of the work that I do now, I've done so much reflection and so much about what was I like at the beginning of my career versus, you know, after the illness versus, you know, at the end of my career and then 10 years on. So my mindset has grown and developed and evolved. In terms of the adversity, the biggest setback that I experienced, so I, at the age of 26, was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And as you know, this is an illness. Yeah, it's a serious illness. This isn't a couple of days in bed that's going to cure this. Yeah, it hit me like a train. I was devoid of all energy. Permanently exhausted, muscles in intense pain. You know, like I said, I could rattle off 100 press-ups 2 months earlier, and then I couldn't even lift my hands up here to stand with my hands on my head, washing my hair for more than 10 seconds in the shower because it was just too painful. And, you know, sleep wouldn't even allow me to recoup any energy. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be like the iPhone with the red bar on going, it's like it's been plugged in all night and it hasn't recharged. What's going on? And so those were just the physical symptoms, though, and the mental and emotional battle was something else. Frustrating because there's a lot of mystery and mystique still about what it is and what its cures are and its causes. So a lot of doctors don't know. They say that all you can do is rest. There's no treatment. At a certain point, I was told I'd never race again. You know, just wait. And then you read forums and it's like, oh, someone's been suffering for this for the last 15 years and they're bedbound. Like, that's not what I need to hear right now. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of really, really negative reading to be done around that, which I just tried to avoid. But frustrating also because it's an invisible illness that people can't see. And so they, you look fine. And you, and so people just think that you're okay. And I, how could, well, there's nothing wrong with you. You look great. And, you know, I spent a winter in Florida because that's where I was with my, based with my training partners. So I'm like tanned, I still look fit. And, you know, I look like I'm, I look like an athlete still. And they're like, what's wrong with you? And so I was frustrated to the point that I actually wished that my, I was covered in spots or that, you know, so that people could, there was something that people could see and understand and see the pain that you're going through, and they didn't. So yeah, so I did spend some time wallowing in a bit of self-pity and why me, why now, and all of that. It was, I was 2003, this was when I got diagnosed, year before Athens Olympics, which was hoping to be my second Olympic Games. I had the World Championships in 6 months' time, you know, so there was all of that emotional battle to go through, as well as the whole illness and what do I do about it. So yeah, mentally, emotionally, physically, really super challenging. And then it went on for 2 years. Until eventually I discovered a treatment called reverse therapy, and my sponsors helped me discover that. I was sponsored by a brilliant company called Pindar, who supported me all the way through it. And so, yeah, eventually I discovered reverse therapy, and that I tried lots of different things and I tried lots of different treatments, all to no avail. And then I discovered this treatment called reverse therapy, and yeah, I won't go into it, but that allowed me to recover from the illness. And it was a challenging, obviously, road back. But the biggest and the first and most important step that I took was opening up to people about it. I have to say that was the biggest thing that I did to start to recover. Because if I hadn't been totally honest about the struggles that I was going through, I wouldn't have got the help that I needed. And I wasn't very good at opening up. That wasn't what I did. And I wasn't very good at showing weakness, exposing that vulnerability. And, you know, I was the athlete, you know, as an athlete, you're always like poker face. Yeah, I'm strong and turn up to a race. Yeah, I've had 2 weeks off with an injury, but you're not going to know about that. And I'm really, you know, I'm really tough and I'm ready. And so, you know, you put the game face on and you're used to that persona. And so, yeah, you just don't open up. And so then even when it became to the illness, I'm super close with my sister, you know, I've got family and friends, and I didn't really open up to anyone. You know, eventually I did, because I didn't want to cry in front of them and didn't want to show them that I was really struggling with it all. And actually now, and actually with the reverse therapy, they discovered that, you know, these symptoms quite often are triggered by non-expression of emotion. It's a very much a mind-body thing. Anyway, so I learned that opening up, asking for help is what was going to make me stronger. And when I did start to ask for help, and that is what helped me massively. And I, as I said, wasn't the kind of person who did that, but I learned to ask for help, and I ask for help a whole lot more now. And I think that being vulnerable enough to ask for and accept support is a huge part of our resilience. It really is. And I think, and so that it's a massive message for me. I do a lot of work around resilience. I do a lot of work around resilient leadership. And even as a leader, I think it's really important to be able to ask for help. And, you know, people think actually, oh, I've got to show weakness or show vulnerability. And, you know, I'm going to lose credibility if I do that. And I'm like, well, you know, I remember working with a client recently, a coaching client, and she was like, oh, but if I sort of show some vulnerability, you know, people are going to think I'm not very capable, or I'm not going to be able to deliver on this project, and, you know, I'm going to look weak. And so, okay, well, what are the downsides? Let's talk about what are the upsides as well, if you did ask for help, or what are the, you know, so going through the pros and cons. And she's like, well, actually, if I don't ask for help, then I might not figure out the best way to do this. I do know one way, but there might be a better way. And actually, I could get support, and I could get perhaps different perspectives, and actually, I could deliver something even better if I just reached out and said, oh, I'm not quite sure. Or if I don't ask for help, I might just do it wrong, and I might not deliver the best possible outcome. And then I'll really lose credibility if I screw it up. So actually, it's worth, you know, showing a bit of vulnerability to deliver a better outcome. Mm. And also, as a you know, if I'm a leader and I've got a team, I'm not going to trust people who don't ask for help. Because if you're a bit out of your depth and you are, you know, you're thinking this is a good way to do it, but, and there's possibly a better way, but I'm not going to ask about it, then you probably don't value this whole project or whatever it is as much as I do. I'm not going to delegate this out to you if you're not prepared to show a bit of vulnerability and ask for help. If you are, I'm going to trust you more. And so that's quite interesting, isn't it? To turn it around like that. And it takes real strength and not weakness to show, to ask for help and to show a bit of vulnerability. Actually, it's a massive sign of strength. And that's a massive thing that I learned. And so to answer one of your questions, you know, what have I learned? That's one of my biggest learnings is being vulnerable enough to ask for help.
Amazing. Because we're all human beings. We don't allow ourselves to just accept that we do have weaknesses. We do have things that we're not perfect at. Like, I can only say that as well from my own experience of like having what was loosely diagnosed as perfectionism, which I think a lot of people have, and or high achievers or those who aspire to be. I remember I was in an interview once and they asked me what my weaknesses is, and I literally couldn't tell them. I couldn't find one because I was so resistant to even accepting them myself that I couldn't verbalize it. But through going through that, everyone has weaknesses. Everyone has weaknesses. And like you said, when you're vulnerable with people, the moment you drop your guard, it's when someone else does. And that's how you build relationships. That's how you get real bonds with people.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the only way to, as a leader in business, you know, this is a big thing I tell my clients, is you have to go first. Mm, yeah. You have to be the one with the courage to role model that and put your hand up and go, I need some help here, guys. Mm. And that's okay, because as a leader, you're not expected to have all the answers. That's why you have people with different expertise, right? And we know that cognitive diversity will give us the richest solution to a crisis. So we need to reach out and collaborate with others and assume there's always different questions to ask and different perspectives to see a problem. And so the strongest leaders will reach out and go, guys, get me some ideas on this. I've got this problem, but I don't really know how to solve it. And actually, I'm going to pride myself on not being the man or the girl with all the ideas. And that's okay. But what I am going to pride myself on is collecting brilliant, diverse perspective and then picking the best idea. Mm. And I'm okay with not knowing at all. And actually, when you know, I've had so many leaders I work with who come back and go, do you know what? I opened up and I said, you know, I'm struggling with this. And can you know, what are your thoughts on that? And then it opens the floodgates. Mm-hmm. And then everyone else is going, oh, do you know what? I'm struggling with this. Can you help me on that? And then all of a sudden they're collaborating and the relationships build and the trust builds. And, you know, that's at the foundation of a high performing team or, you know, leader is building trust. Mm. And we need vulnerability based trust, not predictive trust where I can trust you to deliver that. It's trust that I can open up and you're not going to hold it against me. Trust that you're not going to laugh at me when I say I've messed up, or that you're not going to hold it against me that I've made a mistake, or, you know, that kind of vulnerability-based trust is what I work on a lot.
You've just painted such an amazing picture for me that you even made me actually think of people who I know can't be vulnerable, who are almost afraid of being found out, who are bad leaders, and ones who are very open and very honest, who are really great leaders. You made me think of specific people, which was great. And Sir Clive Woodward said to me that there's never any dumb questions. What he was good at as a leader was just implementing the good ones.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
So he'd get all of this advice from everybody. The example he used was they were one of the first people ever to change their shirts at halftime, because they noticed the first 20 minutes was always the best part of their performance in the first half. Not the same in the second half. So he's got them to change their shirts. So they could match that, mirror that as I went out in the second half. And he said that wasn't his idea. Everyone thought it was. He was just good at implementing it. He just, one of the players said it at some stage.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple of selfish questions about what you spoke about.
Okay.
Which I hope people will get something from as well. But so this is one of the reasons why I was really excited to speak with you. When I was 26 as well, funnily enough, you said you were 26. I also got diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. They just said a mild version, but it's like going through that for the past, it probably was about 2 years for me as well, the worst bit. But essentially the NHS don't know how to diagnose it because they don't really understand what it is. So if you have any sort of fatigue for 6 months, which I think lots of people go through, and they just have to suffer through it and they never really learn the truth behind it. I had blood tests and all this stuff and was never really given a clear answer, but it slowly got better as time went past. So that was my bit of hope that I knew. My marker was Christmas. So every Christmas I'd be like, all right, do I feel better now? Like, how does this compare to the last year? And it's probably like 4 or 5 years when it was still noticeable on probably a weekly basis. But like, I got so much from that. But I know you said so the reverse therapy, that was one of the first times outside of people asking for you to come on who listened to this that I learned about you, because my auntie sent me the website for reverse therapy. And obviously you're on there as a testimony of someone who's had chronic fatigue, overcome it with his practices. I can't remember, is it Damon someone?
Dr. John Eaton.
Eaton, that's it, yeah. John Eaton, yeah. So I inquired, this is years ago, they sent me the book. They said you have to read the book before you go in. So I read the book. So because I think it's really important, this bit. So what you've learned because of the fatigue, however you want to say that, mind, body, spirit, whatever, like that connection, it's not the different things, it's all part of the same thing. Are you all right just discussing some of those things and that kind of philosophy and understanding of how the body works? And,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
What's reverse therapy or
Well, I suppose that would be good to answer as well, but more of the like, what has been the education through going through that process of learning about how the body works, learning about the mind? And then I suppose, what's your belief around why you got the fatigue in the first place? Because I think so many people have these underlying things that they don't address, which leads to various illnesses.
Yeah, so I can't talk to you in medical terms about, you know, the physiology of what's going on. I did read the book and it was brilliant and that really helped me. And I wholeheartedly believe in the reverse therapy process. The way that I describe it is that there are these symptoms, you know, and there are these core symptoms. And there's lots of wide ranging symptoms, but for most people, it's the fatigue, you know, the muscle pain, potentially the brain fog, you know, things like that. And there are all these symptoms and they're like alarm bells going off in your body. And they're your body's way of telling you that there are things that you are doing in your life, your relationships, your environment, pressures you're putting on yourself, stresses, work, whatever it might be, that your body doesn't like. And it's your body's way of telling you to stop doing it or to change something. And there are a variety of triggers that cause those symptoms. And basically, they start off quite mild. And most people who experience chronic fatigue syndrome or ME, will say that they've had some very minor symptoms, maybe a couple of weeks of that, and then, you know, it's fine and it goes away. And this was my experience, was that I probably had 2 or 3 years of very minor little episodes where it'd be like 2 weeks, I couldn't train properly, and then it'd be a 4 week period or a 6 week period. And all the time the doctors were going, oh, it's overtraining, you've overtrained. And so I'd stop and I'd recover. And so I've changed a few things, you know, because I've stopped and I recover in that period, but then I go back to what I was doing before in exactly the same way. And so there's these little things, and eventually the symptoms just get louder and the alarm bells are ringing louder and louder and louder until eventually your body goes, you're not listening. You're just not listening to the warning signs here. And so I'm going to force you to stop now. And you're not going to be able to do what you're currently doing. You're going to have to stop your training, your life, your job, you know, whatever it is, until you get the message, get the damn message, you know, it's like that. And most people don't get the message because they don't know what the message is and they don't know how to change or what they're doing that the body doesn't like, because they're not tuned in to the mind and the body. And so those triggers are very different for every person. I do know that they say that non-expression of emotion, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the most common triggers. And that was classic for me. You know, here was me, this person who just wasn't speaking up, even when I had the illness. And that was why that was a big game changer for me. But So I'll give you a couple of examples for me. I mean, there was lots of things going on for me, but one of the things was that I was, training for the Sydney 2000 Olympic Games, and I went off to train in, so I left the coach who had taken me to, so in my sport, I won 6 world titles in marathon kayak racing, which is not an Olympic discipline. The Olympic discipline is over 500 meters. So one's a 2.5 hour race, one's a 2 minute race, or less than 2 minutes, 1 minute 50. So anyway, that's a whole other
story. Would have won.
That's a whole other, I'd like to think so. That's a whole other story. But so I was sort of leaving marathon to focus. I didn't leave it entirely because I returned to it, but I was focusing for the next, you know, couple of years, trying to get to the Olympic Games. Sydney was my big focus. So I went and trained with another coach, and they were Canadian. He was Canadian with a training group of training partners. A friend of mine was Canadian. So I went out to, they based themselves in Florida for most of the winter. And that year we went out in November, and then we went back after Christmas and basically trained there till Olympic trials. And I came home in April, and they were French Canadian, and they were lovely, really friendly. And then I made loads of improvement. It was a brilliant training program. Loved it. Did great. Made the Olympic team, all brilliant. And so, but when I was back in the UK, and this path, this sort of environmental way of training went on for for 3 years until I got the illness. So I would, a lot of the time in the UK, train on my own. So I had my club, I would go to my club, but I wouldn't join in with the training with my group. I would go out and train on my own, with a training program, that a training session that my coach had set for me. He'd email it across to me. We'd possibly talk in that, you know, not every day, but, you know, we'd communicate. But I was doing day in, day out training on my own. And then occasionally I would join in with some things with other people, and I'd have a training partner. But by and large, I was doing a lot of stuff on my own. And I thought all I needed to do was train hard. And I thought all I needed to do was not just train hard, but do the right training program. I was all about the right training program. I need to do this training program. This is going to get me to improve. And I thought that was all I needed. And I thought I was a robot who could just, and I was really motivated to turn up on my own and do the training. I didn't need people there to push me along to work really hard. I didn't need that. I was motivated enough on my own. But what I needed, I only discovered, you know, down the line, was I needed human connection. I'm an extrovert. I get my energy from other people. And I was turning up every day on my own without anyone. Where am I getting my energy from? No wonder I was exhausted. I didn't have that. I didn't have that, you know, what happened after the illness and when I returned. I was like, I have to have training partners now. Every day, I've got to have training partners. I've got to have coach on the bag every day. Mm-hmm. I'm not going back to that environment. Because that's where I'm getting my energy. I need to bounce off people. Like I said, you know, sometimes I love turning up for the training for the people, because I'm an extrovert who gets energy from people. And I also would get frustrated because my coach wasn't there. I didn't have anyone to complain about the session was hard, or I can't do this, or I'm not sure if I'm doing this right, or, you know, that feedback as well. I wasn't getting that. I would talk to my coach, but there's a 5 hour time difference, so it wasn't immediate. I would talk to him later on, and occasionally I'd get one of the Team GB coaches, you know, with me. But by and large, I wasn't getting the support emotionally. Is what I wasn't getting. And then sometimes my coach wouldn't send the training program on time, and I wouldn't know what to do. And I'm ringing him up at 7:05 before I'm about to get on the water. Where's my training? What am I doing? And I would get really frustrated, but wouldn't tell him that, because I was really grateful that he was keeping me on as a coach. And all of the rest of the athletes were with him in Canada, they were in Quebec. And I felt like a bit of like, oh, I'm just really lucky to be a part of this and that I'm getting a program from you. And so I didn't speak up and say that it was frustrating, or tell anyone how I was feeling, that non-expression of emotion. And so that's an example of how my body, brain, you know, I didn't like that. I wasn't even aware of it. I didn't even notice that I was probably really quite unhappy, but I was so focused on achieving the goal that that's all I cared about. And so now today I talk to people about just slowing down, because when we fill every moment of our day being busy, you know, doing things, rushing from one thing to the next, we don't leave any space or any time to even observe what's going on in our mind and our body. We don't leave any time to for new ideas to be born, to be creative, to notice how we're feeling, you know, any of that, because we're so busy and we're so rushed off our feet that we don't stop. And I was just so focused on trying to achieve this goal that I didn't even notice that I wasn't really enjoying the process. Mm. And I wasn't happy. So that was a big learning. So that's an example of, you know, recognizing for other people's, you know, it's going to be all different things. But for me, that was a big environmental and emotional thing. Mm. I had a variety of triggers. But yeah, it's about identifying the mind and the body, what's going on, and listening to your body.
What did you do to slow down? Was there anything like tangible, or was it something that you picked up in reverse therapy? Are there like things that you started to do day to day to give yourself that space and to force yourself to slow down? And ultimately what it is self-awareness, as you said, but understanding yourself, isn't it? Being in touch with what's going on in your body. Like, was there anything specific that you did?
Well, so when I was going through the illness, I had already slowed right down. So it was a massive slowdown. But when I go back to, so when I look at my training day before the illness versus after the illness, so I used to be very busy. And that was a big stressor for me, actually, was I just would go training, you know, we're training three times a day, you know, 4 or 5 hours of training a day, but I would go to training. And then, you know, I'd come home and I'd be writing a blog, I'd be on my website, or I'd be out in the afternoon doing an event for my sponsor, or in the evening. I'd be, you know, just, I had this constant need to be busy, to be doing something, achieving something in between training. So rather than just, and I did relax, but and tried to recover, but I didn't recover as much as I should have done in between training. And it was just constant, you know, treadmill of going from training to this to, oh, I'm going to go and get drive to the massage, and I'm going to go and drive to see the sports psychologist, and I'm going to fit this in, I'm going to fit that in, and then I'm going to go and read the book on sports psychology, and I'm going to, you know, it was just relentless. And then, you know, and unless at a certain point we were training at Bisham Abbey and I was living in Wimbledon, and that was quite far away, and just, so I'm doing a lot of traveling and it's just too much. And trying to cram too much into my day, and when I should have just been resting in between training, I should have been recovering. And whilst there were things that I enjoyed doing, I put a lot of pressure on myself to do lots of things and to be busy. And I think that I just needed to slow right down and take some of those things out, just focus on recovery. And that's a really big message that, you know, I talk about resilience, talk about energy management with my corporate clients, and I talk about the need to just switch off in the day. I'm really big on breathing techniques to help calm that nervous system, you know.
Could you do one with us?
Could I do one now?
You've got like a short one you could do.
Yeah, totally. So I just, I would just ask people to sit comfortably in their chair, wherever they're listening to this right now, and to just focus on your breath. So to just start by noticing it, because we don't even notice it so much of the time. You know, we breathe automatically. Great, brilliant. But we need to just tune into our breath. So just be aware of it. The rise of the breath as you inhale. And then notice the fall of the breath as you exhale. Breathing in. And breathing out. And then inhale for a little bit longer and deeper than you're used to. Slightly longer inhale. And then a slightly deeper, longer exhale. And then if you can, aiming for around 4 to 5 seconds on the inhale. So breathing in for around 4 to 5 seconds, if that feels comfortable. And then exhaling for around 4 to 5 seconds. And on that exhale, let go of any tension. Breathing in for around 4 to 5. And breathing out for around 4 to 5 seconds. And then just do one more round of that on your own. And then just observe. What do you notice? What do you notice in mentally, physically, emotionally? What changes?
Just amazing how quickly it happens. I just feel back in the room. I think is in my head, I'm thinking about the next question I want to ask. I'm thinking about where the conversation's going. I'm thinking about, oh, am I doing a good job? Like, just immediately just back in the room, and there's a weight that goes off. I don't know. I've done a lot of breath work and meditation, so I don't know if it's that muscle was just immediately kicked in. Now it's easier or not.
But yeah, it is easier the more you practice it. But, you know, so I use some biofeedback technology to do this with clients. And so we can measure the heart rate variability. Mm. And I do this in workshops and they love it. People, this is probably one of the things that people love the most out of all the work that I do, because they see it in real time and you connect this sensor and you can see someone's heart rate on the screen. And I usually make them feel a little bit nervous beforehand. So we see this really chaotic heart rhythm and then we calm them down and we do the breathing and you see this real contrast. And every single time people say, when I ask that question, what do you observe? They say, I feel calm, or they say, I feel relaxed. And they also say, and maybe you experience this as well, that my mind is quiet, or the thoughts have slowed down. And that is so powerful for people who live a busy, fast-paced life where there's just, you know, like that partial inattention where I'm just constantly tuned in to hundreds of different things and never fully focused and the mind's racing all the time, all day long. I'm like, how useful would that be? We did that for like 60 seconds just now. To have 60 seconds in your day when you just quieten the mind. And the health benefits are a whole nother thing. You know, the ability to just calm the autonomic nervous system, kick in that parasympathetic system, which helps us to relax, helps us to slow down, you know, because we're constantly triggering the sympathetic branch that raises heart rate, raises blood pressure, you know, kicks in the adrenaline, all of that. And when you're kicking that in all day long, that's why we're exhausted at the end of the day. And I didn't learn that until later in my career. And I wish I'd known that before. But it's just so powerful to just, so on so many levels, from a health perspective, from a managing stress perspective, from an ability to stay present. So instant, you know, I'm back in the room, you know. And so just noticing and being present. And when people do that, they return to their work and they're just focused. And it's like, oh, I know what I need to do next. I know how to solve this problem. I know what direction I need to go in. Just that moment of clarity, because all of a sudden the emotional center in the brain quietens down, and that prefrontal cortex that you're talking about, it kicks in again. That rational strategic thinking kicks in, which it can't do when we're stressed and we're busy and we're angry about something. You can't think clearly. And so, you know, I work with athletes on, you know, on teaching them these techniques. I've worked with business people, with kids at exam time, with my son doing his grading. You know, everyone can just breathe. I've got to breathe anyway. So just breathe a little bit longer and deeper. And I know that you've probably tried differently, there's so many breathing techniques. This one is based on the Institute of Heart Math. So I trained as a heart math practitioner. It was the first training I did actually back in 2010. And they've done a lot of research on when you breathe in that way, five in, five out, you achieve what we call a coherent heart rhythm. And there's a lot of research and science behind the benefits of that, both physically and mentally. So that's why I recommend that one. But I know there are lots of different breathing techniques that work for people.
Thanks for that. And I genuinely feel so much better. And thanks for sharing the story about the fatigue and everything as well. I think it's so powerful. And I think we all want to feel like we've got more energy. And that's a way to do it. And although we look at it as, or some do anyway, the kind of woo-woo breath work or meditation and all that, ultimately it helps our performance in everything that we do.
Yeah, it's about, for me, it's about performance. Yeah. That's what I dedicate my life to, is high performance.
Yeah.
And you know, no one's ever had a eureka moment of you know, the solution come to them when they're stressed. Mm-hmm. When you're living this busy, fast-paced life, most people, you probably with your clients, you know, their best ideas come to them when they're walking, mm-hmm. or, you know, when you're going on a walking coaching session, or you're doing exercise at the end of the day. That's when the creativity comes, when we've switched off. You don't get the eureka moment in the stress of the busy day. So for me, it's about performance. You think, and so look, watch the football right now. You know, actually, you know what? Tennis. I was at the Wimbledon tennis on Tuesday. I put a post out about this on LinkedIn on Tuesday about recovery. So you know how in tennis they have 25 seconds to serve between the points, and they have 90 second changeover. So they get to, they walk to the seat, don't they? And then they sit there and they've got, you know, 60 seconds by the time they've sat down. So they've got a 90 second recovery. So I watched a match with Venus Williams on Tuesday. It was a 2 hours and 37 minutes. And the only recovery those players got was those 25 seconds between the points and 90 seconds every now, you know, after every other set, every other game. And the best tennis players in the world maximize that micro recovery time, that 90 seconds. They use that, you know, you see Venus was brilliant at it. You could just visibly see her in between the points, big deep breaths, bringing the heart rate back down, clearing the mind before I take the next shot so I can focus. What, you know, what's a great shot look like? You know, how am I going to place this serve? You know, all that, that help, that allows you to think like that when you can just breathe and clear the mind. And then, you know, she's there doing it on the chair when she's in that 90 seconds. She's taking a, you know, a little sip of water. She's having a bite of a banana, you know. I'm like, that's what we need to be doing during our working day is building recovery. You know, so my question that I wrote on this post, you know, what are you doing to recover between the points during your working day? Even just a 60 second, you know, bit of breathing. Everyone's got 60 seconds in their working, in an hour throughout their working day. Don't tell me you don't have a minute. Everyone's got a minute. So you can just take a minute to breathe and you will perform better. So for me, it's about performance, you know, that recovery time and doing that breathing. It's about getting the best out of yourself.
It's such good advice. Even in a meeting, let's say you're in an hour meeting.
Absolutely.
You can sit there and breathe. Like, people won't know. Or just, you can sit there and breathe and just calm yourself down. Or there's, I was talking before, for people listening, Anna and I were geeking out over coaching methods before we started recording. But the even tactile, just to have that focal point on your fingers, feeling the grooves of your fingers, and or just really listening to something. Like that focal point, rather than the distraction or the blur or the wondering everything else. There's different ways of doing it. I think you're absolutely right. The 60 seconds, I love that as well.
What but you're it's doing like all that, what you're describing, it's just bringing you present, right? It's just switching off all that noise and make you present in the room. And how important is that when you're in the middle of a conversation with someone? But the breathing, you know, you talk about doing it in a meeting, and I always encourage my clients to do that, because if you're in a meeting and you're getting a bit wound up and you're getting a bit stressed with this meeting, and I don't like how this is going, and you can feel the tension rising, then if you can just take a moment, you can still listen, but you can breathe and calm yourself down, then you're going to respond more appropriately to that person who's talking and who's winding you up. Otherwise, you're just going to react and you're going to say the wrong thing, and you're going to walk out of the room and you're going to regret what you said. Or, you know, it's that thing where you're going to walk out and you go, oh God, I should have said this, I should have said that. And all the brilliant ideas come to you when you've left, when you've left the room. And it's like, oh, damn it, why didn't I think of that then? You didn't think of it then because the prefrontal cortex has switched off and you're being emotionally driven, and you're being driven by anger and frustration, rather than taking a few breaths and letting that cortex kick in and be driven by rational strategic thinking. So, about performance.
Yeah, back in that limbic brain we were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good. So one more question before we'll do the quick fire at the end. There's three short questions at the end, but one more. So I watched the video last night of you. It was in the 2005 World Championships. There was three of you in the kayak marathon, which was, is it 22 miles?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was three of you, and you've been going for, what, a couple of hours at this point. And you're neck and neck. In fact, you're probably second or third when the video starts. It's the last little bit of it. And just for context, there's a part where you jump out of the kayak.
The portage,
go across the sand and into the next part, and then you go and sort of the last little straight of the race. But the moment the video starts, there's three of you, and then you just suddenly flick. And it's like poetry in motion, and you just obviously make that decision to move. You jump out of the kayak like effortlessly while you see the other two kind of like clambering out a little bit. You sprint across the sand carrying your kayak, jump back in within like milliseconds, and you are so far ahead of them now at this point. You've just, within the space of 30 seconds, you've made a huge, or even less, maybe 10, 15 seconds, you made a huge gap between the other two, and then you go on to win the championship. So I guess, what was that moment like for you, and what was going through your mind as you, how were you operating in that moment? And then if you could just summarize for listeners three ways that we can all improve our performance, that'd be amazing.
So leading up to that point, that didn't just happen by magic. So I have visualized that, you know, thousands of times And this is my comeback race, right? Like, this is 2005. So I had the honors in 2003. This was my first World Championships back.
No way.
So I'd done other races throughout the year. Not many at all. I did the European Championships earlier in the year, a couple of months before that. It was October. I probably did that like July, and won just really, really close. But this was the race that I had come back for. You know, this is what had kept me going, really, you know, in those dark days, you know, of the illness. This is what reminded me why the struggle was going to be worth it. And actually, I did an interview with Eurosport a day or two before, and they were like, "So if you win this, what will it mean to you?" And I just burst into tears. I was like, "Oh, it's going to mean so much." But anyway, I digress. But so I had been planning this in my head. You know, I'm massive on visualization, really, really big on visualization. So this is the answer to your first question: is what can we do to improve our performance? Is we can visualize it. We can visualize what we want to deliver, how we want to perform. So whether that's, you know, getting up to present in front of the board, or getting up to do a speech, or, you know, or whatever it is, have a difficult conversation with a colleague, you've got to give some difficult feedback. You can visualize the conversation. You can visualize the presentation. And so I used to visualize, because it's a 2.5 hour race, you can't visualize it from, you know, when I was the Olympic race, I'd visualize the minute and 50 seconds you used to do from start to finish, but the marathon, you can't. So you'd pick out key points, like, so the portage really key, the start, you know, going around certain turns, the finish, if it was going to end up as a sprint finish, you know. So there's certain elements that you'd visualize, but I absolutely visualized that portage part. But also, so lead. I had a plan, you know. So you go into a race, and you never know quite how the race is going to pan out. But you have a strategy. You have your strategy, but you don't know what your competitors are planning. So it's very much, I've got a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. And my plan was to lead into that final portage, which was 6 kilometers from the finish. You know, I know I'm a good runner. I know I can get out really quick. The girls are tired. You can tell, you know, when they get out of the boat. One of them had a lot of water in her bow. But anyway, so I knew my plan was to lead into the portage, start sprinting into portage, sprint around as fast as I can, get back in. But I think I probably make it look quite easy, but actually jumping out of the boat, jumping back in the boat, I've fallen in once at a World Cup race, jumping back in. I wasn't careful. I slipped. And so I went away and practiced that a lot. And not many people do practice that. Getting in and out, it's like we've just got to get in and out of the boat. But actually, if you want to do it quick and execute it slickly, you got to practice it like anything. So one, I used to practice it a lot. I used to go and find, but also the sand bit, right? And so running on sand, I used to train running on sand. We're like kayakers. We were on the water in a kayak. I used to go and train running on the sand. Even though it's, like you say, a 30-second part of a 2.5 hour race, that was the difference for me, right? That's the winning margin, was being quick running on the sand. I don't know how many other athletes were training on the sand to be quick on that portage. And you hear the commentator actually saying, you don't often win on a portage. You can lose on a portage, but you don't usually win. I'm like, I'm going to win on the portage. Yeah. So for me, those are like the marginal gains that I was looking to make the difference. I'm very good at digressing, aren't I? So visualization. So that was it. You know, I'd seen it 1,000. I'd literally visualized myself from the moment that I was right, I'm going to make a break, to getting out of the water, running around, getting back in again. I'd seen it 1,000 times. I've seen what could go right, what I want to happen. I've also seen what could go wrong. And that's really crucial, not because I want a plan for it to go wrong, but because if something does go wrong, then I'm not fazed by it. And I can react, and I know how I need to respond. So if something does happen getting out, or, you know, I drop the boat for some reason going through the portage or whatever, I know I'm just going to autopilot. I'm just going to manage that situation really easily. But by and large, I'm focusing on what I want to happen, so that when it happens, and I think that, and when you're, you know, we've been racing for 2 hours, we're exhausted. Because I've visualized it, I think that's what allows you to deal with the pressure of the situation and reenact it almost regardless of how your body is feeling. And so you can just go through the pain, and you just, you know, you're so focused and you're operating on autopilot that it just happens. And so that helps you to enhance performance. But the other thing about visualization for me is that it gave me so much confidence. that I've seen it. And your mind, when you visualize something really vividly, your mind doesn't know the difference between a vividly imagined experience and a real life experience. And for me, that was so true, because I just knew when I nailed the visualization, I knew I was ready. I was like, I've seen it. I've seen it happen. And it felt so real. I know I can do this. And I had that before. I remember there was one big Olympic trials race that I was doing, and I just, days leading up, I'm nervous. And then I saw the visualization and I saw it and I nailed it. And I'm like, I'm ready to race. Let's bring it on. And I go from, oh, a bit nervous, but scared, to bring it on. I just want to race. I just want to get out there and do this. And that's what visualization did for me. So that's the first thing that I can share with you about improving performance. And it also starts to drive into the subconscious, the creative subconscious, about the things that you need to do to achieve the goal. So it starts to help you be creative about, this is what I'm trying to achieve. What do I need to achieve that? And creative ideas. And it kicks in that law of attraction as well, I believe, of drawing into your life those things, the resources, the people, the environment that you need to achieve the goal. You know, it's a bit like the reticular activating system, you know, the RAS. It's like all of a sudden you're noticing the things that I need and what I need to achieve. And how I'm going to do it. So it's really super powerful. And I've done work with neurofeedback, which is about putting electrodes on the brain. And you can actually see the parts of the brain that light up when you visualize. And the stronger the visualization, the more activity there is in that part of the brain. So we know through neuroscience that this is powerful stuff and that it works. And I know from my own experience, regardless of the neuroscience, that works.
It's nice to see that too, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So I can't remember the question. Does that help about what was going through my mind in that moment?
I mean, yeah. Look, it just sheds light on, because you watch it and you're like, wow, that's just unbelievable how quickly you did that, how fluidly you did it. You just must be really good at kayaking and at the portage part of the race. But it's not about that. It's about like everything that went on behind the scenes. And then visualization, unbelievable. So that could be your first one. Two others.
Yes. What was that? How can people improve their performance?
Yeah, so by tapping into and utilizing visualization, what would be two more ways?
I think confidence is at the foundation of all high performance. So I could just say, you know, build confidence, but then people go, how do I build confidence? That's really helpful. Just be more confident. And that's really annoying when people say things like that. I mean, you need to be more confident. Be more confident. Believe in yourself. Well, how do I do that? So for me, confidence comes from, I think we mentioned this earlier, knowing your strengths, knowing what you're great at. Yes, we need to be aware of our weaknesses, and for sure we need to develop those. But I think that, you know, if I sat on that start line and I was focused on my weaknesses, my confidence is going to be fragile. You know, all the things I need to avoid doing. Actually, no, I need to know in that moment. Yes, in the training days, I need to work on certain things. But in that moment when I'm going to perform, I need to know what I'm brilliant at. I need to have that on the tips of my fingers. And the people that I coach, and they'd start with me and in the beginning, and they're like, what are you good at? Oh, I don't really know what my strengths are. And then by the end, they're like, I'm rattling off my strengths. And I know what I'm great at now. And that just transforms confidence. So finding ways to identify what your strengths are and then exploiting them, making the most of them, do them more frequently is really important. And then people go, well, how do I know what my strengths are? So I'm going to give you another tip to find out what your strengths are. And so this is something that I stole from the world of golf. So golfers would used to write the three-shot diary. And the three-shot diary is all about, you know, they would come home at the end of the day and at the end of a tournament, and they go back to the hotel room and they'd write in their diary the three, no matter how good that day's round was, worst round or the best round, they would write the three best shots of the day. And, you know, you do that 7 days a week, got 21 best shots at the end of the week. And so no matter whether you won or lost the tournament at the end of the week, you've played the practice round in the first couple of days and you've done your tournament, you've got 21 great shots that you delivered that week. And you do that week in, week out, you know, and they play how many weeks of a year? All of a sudden, you've got over 1,000 shots. Oh, I can't do the math in my head, 21 times 50. You know, over 1,000 shots in a year. And so no matter how good or bad the season was, I've got 1,000 brilliant shots that I'm focused on, rather than focused on all the shots that did badly. And like, get to the end of the week, you know, oh, I lost the tournament, shit. And I played that shot badly and I messed that one up. Actually, I'm focused on what I did really well. And so that's what, you know, how many of us celebrate what we do well every day? And it doesn't have to be massive things every day. Oh, I got this new deal and I got this new client and I signed this contract. It's just small stuff. Like, I went and had that difficult conversation that I could have avoided. Or I checked in with that person who I could have, you know, I couldn't really be bothered to, but I did. And that made them feel better. And actually, we both felt better. And, or, you know, just noticing that I delivered under pressure in that moment, in the to the deadline or whatever it is. And just making a note of that and the very act of writing it down actually is more important than just thinking it at the end of the day. It's actually it's called the three-shot diary. So it's actually writing it down. And that's a brilliant way because then you start to notice, oh, actually, I keep doing that really well. I must be really good at that. And I keep having really great conversations and giving really good feedback to people. Actually, I'm quite good at doing that. And then you start to uncover what your strengths are and what you're good at doing every day.
The three-shot diary is amazing. I love that analogy. That's great. We've talked specifically about golf. A lot of people say, oh, I play for that one good shot around.
Yeah.
But yet all we do is think about
all the bad shots.
It's just easier to beat ourselves
up. But this is that RAS, right? The reticular activating system. It's about what am I choosing to focus on? And this actually, that three-shot diary didn't come from golf. It originally came from, I think it was Martin Seligman's work on positive psychology with people suffering from depression and where they're focused on all the bad things in their life. And actually, they wrote this diary where they were told to focus on things they were grateful for or they were, you know, was going well in their life. And so they were rewiring the brain to look for the good and to look for the great things that are happening. And so that's why you have to do it over a period of time. I think the study was over 6 weeks, or I can't remember. And so likewise with the sport, with the diary, you know, in our work, you've got to do it consistently so that you're tuning, you're rewiring your brain to look for what you do well rather than focusing on the stuff you do badly.
Mm. Tony Robbins says, change your expectation to appreciation.
Yeah.
Yeah. The gratitude thing is amazing as well, I think. Oh, God, that last 10 minutes has been amazing.
And I haven't even given you a third one yet, have I? I can't think of the third one.
Focusing on strengths is one in itself.
Yes. Well, so, I mean, I guess I gave you that because that's how you build your confidence.
Confidence is always... Also, I'm sorry, we do need to wrap this up.
Yeah.
You got to go. But confidence, sorry, I talk too much. That is amazing. Confidence is also, as boring as it sounds, is preparation, like practice is preparation.
Yeah.
All those visualization is a form of practice, which is preparation. And that's another way.
I'm going to give you one really quick final one then, and that's reflection. So we've got to do the preparation, we've got to execute, and then we've got to review. And so that review and that reflection, you know, people always say, oh, we learn from adversity, we learn from failure. Well, we don't learn from the failure unless we reflect on it and decide what we're going to learn from it. So we have to actually do the reflection because it's not the failure alone, it's the learning from the failure that makes us stronger. And so that would be my third one, is to spend time reflecting and learning from our experiences because that's what makes us more resilient and able to apply that learning into the next performance. There we go. That was a quick answer.
Amazing. Anna, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you. It's been great.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mark.
There it is, guys. Thank you so much for joining me. I don't even know where to start with that one. It was amazing. As I said in the introduction, I was in my absolute element. I didn't look at any of the questions that I prepared, and we just pretty much went back and forth for an hour and 40 minutes, I think it was. Thanks so much for tuning in and listening and supporting Take Flight as ever. I'd be really fascinated to hear your thoughts as what landed with you more than other parts of that conversation. There was a lot to take in, a lot to absorb, but I really hope that it was beneficial. Next week on the podcast, we have the final episode in this season with another special guest. Crowned the UK's fittest man in 2020 after winning the UK CrossFit Open. His name is Zach George. You might be familiar with him. He is unbelievable. And we talk all about mindset, goal setting, how to physically reach our optimal on a daily basis. And most importantly, we talk about how to change. Zach was severely overweight in his youth, and one particular moment was the catalyst to make a huge change which transformed his life. I can't wait to share that episode with you guys next week. And in the meantime, stay positive, stay motivated, and take flight.